And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And right now we're going to get into a commentary by Oak. Anyway, this week's commentary is entitled...
Party Pooper. Celebrations are an important part of life. They are meant to be happy, memorable occasions. Unfortunately, many of the celebratory trappings of your basic, 4th of July, birthday, or wedding here in the USA spell disaster for other life forms. The old saw, anything worth doing is worth overdoing, applies here in spades. But we'd like to think that if most people were aware of the consequences of their actions during moments intended to be joyful, they would modify their behavior, right? Maybe. Traditions, be they recent or as old as dirt, have a way of becoming entrenched. Take fireworks. They're so much a part of the 4th of July or other celebrations as to be synonymous. How can you have an Independence Day or the tall ships come in without fireworks? Today, every backwater town in the nation wants to have its own fireworks display. But regardless of who has the means or even why they put out all the effort, it's the what of those pyrotechnics that's the problem. An article in the Earth Island Journal carries some serious eye-openers with regard to what all those airbursts have in store for anything that breathes. The contents of your average fireworks display read like an air quality expert's worst nightmare. Apparently, all those swell colors and effects come with a price. Some examples. Strontium produces blazing reds. Copper compounds burn blue. Magnesium, titanium, and aluminum create brilliant white sparks. Sodium chloride produces orange-yellow fire. Boric acid burns green. Potassium and rubidium compounds produce purples. And burning lithium glows red. Glittering greens are produced by radioactive barium. If Acme Earth Trashers, Inc. were to burn all those things out back of the factory, the EPA would be all over them like flies on shit. But those guardians of our air and water are not about to make a stink about fireworks displays. That would be akin to regulating mother and apple pie. Besides, the unwise abusers and every far-right enemy of the Earth has gone on record already claiming the EPA's new regulations on air quality will outlaw backyard barbecues and fireworks. EPA Director Carol Browner made a big deal of denying that last year. So, the bombs bursting in air and the rocket's red glare will continue unabated. The All-American Birthday Party will continue to dump heavy metals and arsenic into the skies. The Earth Island article notes that the Millennium fireworks in Europe shot 124 tons of lead into the air, while here in the U.S., Y2K partiers added another 90 tons. That's a violation of the Clean Air Act. Remember lead paint and leaded gas? They were banned, and for a good reason. Can anyone tell us why it's okay to blow the stuff up over our communities, but not blow it out our tailpipes? In any case, after you've recovered from those pyrotechnics, maybe it's time for a little barbecue. What? There's a smog alert? Okay, forget the cookout. How about a birthday party for Susie and Johnny? Tie those helium balloons to the mailbox? I don't think so. Whatever you do, if you live anywhere near the coast, keep those suckers inside. The Federal Task Force on Persistent Marine Debris identifies helium balloons as, quote, a non-necessary pollution item, a major source of debris which threatens the lives of marine mammals, close quote. It seems that whales, seals, dolphins, turtles, and some fish and seabirds mistake balloons and other floatable plastics that land on the ocean for their natural prey, like the jellyfish. Upon swallowing, the materials become lodged in their gullets or digestive system, usually leading to death. The U.S. Coast Guard and others have testified that up to 100,000 whales and seals die from this each year. Happy birthday. Rounding off our party pooper's peeve session, we thought we'd throw some cold water on that wedding party. It seems butterfly releases are becoming rather vogue at nuptial ceremonies these days. This may make a nice show, but unfortunately it cannot go so well for our winged friends. According to the North American Butterfly Association, www.naba.org, the American Museum of Natural History, the National Wildlife Federation, and the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, butterfly releases are lame. NWF notes that releasing butterflies can result in the possible introduction of species into areas where they are not native, possibly carrying and spreading diseases. Even if a species is native, a foreign population has a different genetic makeup than the population into which it is introduced. This might result in negative effects on local populations. And they add that introductions are not the solution to dwindling butterfly populations. Habitat conservation and the elimination of pesticides from the food chain are better solutions. So, we think Ashley and Jess should pass on the butterfly concept. If they must release something alive at their ceremony, obviously they can't release balloons, why not that person up front with the Bible or whatever? Let them go home. They don't need the church or state to give them permission to be together for eternity anyway. For Earth First Radio, this is Oak.
Yeah, this is Uncle Dennis. I want to thank Oak for his commentary. Moving on to more animal news, a gamekeeper has been fined for shooting a rare hen harrier. A Scottish gamekeeper was fined for after admitting shooting a hen harrier, one of Britain's rarest birds. Is the first conviction for killing the bird, which is protected under national and European Union law. Douglas Ross is filmed carrying a rare hen harrier. Douglas Ross, 33, keeper of Craig Mill Estates, was fined £2,000 at Elgin Sheriff's Court for shooting a young female bird last July. Ross, who works for the estate owned by Catherine Wills, was convicted on video evidence compiled by two members of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. Hen harriers number about 520 pairs across Britain, of which less than a dozen remain. Sheriff Kenneth Forbes told Ross, "It seems to me that you set out with the purpose of destroying one or more of these particular birds." The Crown accepted his not guilty pleas to shooting a second bird on the same date, having the birds in his possession, and carrying a shotgun for the purpose of killing a wild bird. Duncan Orr Ewing, head of the policy for the Royal Society for Protection of Birds in Scotland, said, "They are beautiful ground-nesting birds of prey, usually found on a remote moorland, but they are also reviled by some gamekeepers because they compete with the hunters by taking young grouse. As a result, hundreds of hen harriers have been systematically killed over the last decade. Adults are shot or poisoned in their nests and young trampled to death. Such crimes have proved virtually impossible to bring before the courts." The Game Conservancy Trust says hen harriers live almost exclusively on grouse moors, where they do economic harm and little has been done to restore their habitat elsewhere. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds says that supplementary feeding of hen harriers with rabbits during the breeding season has been shown to reduce grouse predation by 85%, but this technique has not been widely adopted by the shooting estates. And here on the West Coast, the white abalone has been listed as an endangered species. In response to a petition by the Center for Biological Diversity, the federal government listed the white abalone as an endangered species on May 29th. The abalone is the first, but unfortunately won't be the last, marine invertebrate listed as an endangered species. The white abalone is a marine snail which occurs from Point Conception, California, south to Punta Abreojos in Baja California, Mexico. The Channel Islands off the south the coast of Southern California support some of the last remaining populations. The species once numbered between 2 and 4 million animals, but has been severely depleted by commercial fishing. The most recent surveys estimate that fewer than 2,500 abalone remain, a decline of over 99%. White abalone are broadcast spawners, requiring males and females to be within a few meters of each other for successful fertilization and reproduction to occur. The few abalone that escaped commercial harvest are now too few and far between to successfully reproduce. The lifespan of an individual white abalone is estimated to be between 35 and 40 years. 34 years have passed since the last known successful recruitment of the species in 1966. Scientists predict that the species will be extinct in less than a decade unless immediate action is taken. And we want to thank the Center for Biological Diversity for this news. You can visit their webpage for more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. That's www.biologicaldiversity.org. And a Texas man has been convicted of smuggling endangered pythons. A Houston, Texas man was found guilty of two federal counts related to the smuggling of green tree pythons from Indonesia into the United States. Jeffrey Allen Doth, 32, was found guilty by U.S. District Court George King of bringing five snakes into the country through Los Angeles International Airport in December of 1995, said Acting U.S. Attorney General Consuelo Woodhead. Doth attempted to smuggle the five juvenile pythons, each one of which was about a foot in length, by placing the reptiles in two elastic stockings and strapping them around his waist. Doth attempted to hide the pythons under his baggy shirt during a flight from Jakarta, Indonesia to Los Angeles. After arriving there, Doth failed to declare the pythons to Customs Service officials. Customs inspectors found the pythons when they searched Doth. He faces a maximum sentence of 10 years in federal prison. At trial, Doth testifies he did not hide the pythons under his clothing to conceal them from customs. Rather, he testified, he wrapped the snakes around himself to keep the reptiles warm, as well as to avoid having to pay an extra fare to the airlines. Doth is in the business of buying and selling wildlife, primarily from Southeast Asia. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service testified that in 1994, Doth attempted to import a different illegal wildlife shipment through Los Angeles. That shipment was seized, and Doth was warned that proper procedures for such importations must be followed. Pythons are protected as a threatened species under an international wildlife treaty and require permits for any international trade. When Doth brought the pythons into the country, he did not possess the proper permits or authorization. The pythons, which can reach 6 to 8 feet in length, are now at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. And in other smuggling news, the international trafficker in the world's rarest reptiles has been jailed. An international wildlife smuggler has been sentenced in federal court in San Francisco to 71 months in prison and a fine of $60,000. Kang Liang Anson Wong pleaded guilty to 40 federal charges of trafficking in some of the most endangered reptile species in the world. In addition to Wong, seven other defendants have been convicted or pleaded guilty to federal crimes associated with the smuggling ring. Between 1996 and 1998, Wong spearheaded an international smuggling ring that illegally imported and sold more than 300 protected reptiles native to Asia and Africa. And several of the species involved in the illegal trade are on the brink of extinction. An undercover federal investigation infiltrated this reptile trade. Agents found that Wong illegally imported the reptiles by concealing them in express delivery packages, airline baggage, and large commercial shipments of legally declared animals. The endangered species traded by Wong include the world's largest lizard, the Komodo monitor, also called the Komodo dragon, which is now found only on the three small Indonesian islands of Komodo, Rinca, and Flores. Only an estimated 5,700 of the giant lizards remain. Wong also bought and sold the plowshare tortoise, also called the Madagascan spurred tortoise, believed to be the rarest tortoise species. It is found only on the island of Madagascar off the southeastern coast of Africa. Wong also trafficked in such rare species as the Chinese alligator, which lives on the lower course of the Yangtze River, a false gravel, a crocodile whose range is restricted to parts of Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and southern Thailand, and the radiated tortoise, another species found only on Madagascar. Other species smuggled by Wong include the Gray's monitor, the spider tortoise, the Burmese star tortoise, the Indian star tortoise, Bolen's python, the Timor python, the green tree python, and the Fly River turtle. Trade in the animals smuggled and sold by Wong is regulated under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, an international agreement that controls the importation and exportation of hundreds of imperiled animals and plants. A number of the animals he smuggled are also protected by the U.S. Endangered Species Act, which prohibits the importation of rare animals into the United States for commercial purposes. And the Interior Department is halting a plan for grizzlies in two states. The Interior Department said that it has abandoned a Clinton administration plan to reintroduce grizzly bears into the isolated wilds of Idaho and Montana in what was to have been a bid to help grizzlies, a threatened species, toward recovery. The plan had been highly controversial in the West, and the decision by Interior Secretary Gail Norton comes in deference to those concerns, in particular to a lawsuit by the state of Idaho. Governor Dirk Kempthorne of Idaho, a Republican, sharply attacked the plan for what he called massive flesh-eating carnivores. In a written statement, Ms. Norton pronounced herself fully committed to the recovery of the bears, a threatened species in the lower 48 states where they have been driven off 98% of their range. But, she added, building support from state leaders is an important element to any potential partnership of this size and scope. Supporters of the Clinton plan said Ms. Norton's reversal could be a step backward for the bears and seemed to reflect a lack of commitment to requirements under the Endangered Species Act that call for the government to play an active role in promoting these species' recovery. Secretary Norton is essentially allowing the governor to veto a major conservation initiative in a way that undermines the Endangered Species Act and sets a very dangerous precedent, said Jamie Clark, who headed the Fish and Wildlife Service in the Clinton administration. The decision is the latest in a series of reversals of Clinton-era environmental policies. Among other steps, the new administration has ended American support for the International Treaty on Climate Change, has said it will review new standards for arsenic in drinking water, and has made clear its intention to scale back a plan to put about one-third of the national forests off-limits to development. In 1995 and 1996, the Clinton administration pushed through another controversial plan, the reintroduction of gray wolves into central Idaho and Yellowstone National Park, which is now widely seen as a success. But President Bush promised before the election to be sensitive to local sentiment, particularly in the Intermountain West, a region that felt slighted by Mr. Clinton and his team, and has long been a solid base of Republican political support. The Clinton plan called for the release of 25 grizzlies over 5 years beginning next summer in the Bitterroot Wilderness of central Idaho and western Montana. The last grizzly there was shot in the late 1950s, and the area is regarded by wildlife biologists as prime range for grizzlies, which weigh from 300 to 800 pounds. The plan to reintroduce the bears had been assembled over the last 7 years in negotiations between state, federal, and local officials, conservationist timber industry representatives, and other interested parties. It was approved by the Wildlife Service last November, with the service's grizzly bear coordinator, Chris Servine, saying it maximizes the probability that grizzlies will be around in 100, 200, or 300 years. But the idea of reintroduction has always raised the hackles in communities like Dixie, Idaho, and Hamilton, Montana, on the fringes of the wilderness areas. Some have also voiced worries about potential dangers to hikers and others in the backcountry. Timber companies and state officials in Idaho have also expressed concerns about reintroducing the bears could lead to restrictions on their own use of state and federal forests. Governor Kempthorne filed suit to block the plan in January in federal district court, saying the plan usurped the state's right to regulate land use and interfered with its duty to protect its citizens. There are now about 1,100 grizzly bears in the lower 48 states in Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, and Washington. This compares with about 50,000 believed to have lived here before European settlement. In its announcement, the Interior Department said the Wildlife Service intended now to concentrate recovery efforts and resources on the existing grizzly bear populations, including the largest in the Yellowstone area and in the area of Glacier National Park. Technically, the decision will be cast in terms of a new proposal by the Wildlife Service for the grizzly bear recovery plan, and the public has 60 days to comment on the proposal. And this story was written by Douglas Jehl. And Uncle Dennis would recommend that if you think the grizzly bears need more room, to write to your congressperson and let them know. Endangered species logjam broken. Interior Secretary Gail Norton can't drag her feet and refuse to act on efforts to list animals as endangered species, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled. The three-judge panel rejected contentions by the Department of Interior that simply saying it was considering a species for protection allows it to avoid the deadline set by Congress to make a decision. The ruling almost immediately orders Norton to consider the Gila chub, a minnow living in the rivers of central and southeast Arizona, which has been a candidate for listing for 19 years. The Tucson-based Center for Biological Diversity sued in 1999 after Bruce Babbitt, Norton's predecessor, failed to act. But Kieran Suckling, the center's executive director, said that by voiding Department of Interior policy, the ruling should clear the way for action on 149 species that are listed as candidates. The candidate list has become a bureaucratic limbo, said Suckling. In fact, he said 39 species which had been on the list, some for as much as 20 years, have gone extinct waiting for government action. This is going to be a watershed event in the Endangered Species Act, Suckling said, with the ability now to force the Bush administration to act. Joan Moody, a publicist for the Department of Interior, said her agency was still reviewing the ruling and would not comment. Federal law allows individuals or groups to petition for species protection. Once a petition is filed, the Interior Secretary has 90 days to decide whether there is substantial scientific or commercial information showing the petition may be warranted. If that is true, the Secretary has an additional 9 months to decide whether the species should get protection, whether the listing is unwarranted, or if protection is appropriate will be precluded by other proposals. The chub, a minnow averaging 5 to 8 inches in length, first appeared as a candidate for listing as early as 1982 and now lives in fewer than 15 streams in the Gila River Basin in central and southeastern Arizona. The Chiricahua leopard frog, first considered in 1991, averages 3 to 4 inches long, with what the center describes as a unique snore-like mating call. It is found in the Mogollon Plateau in Arizona and New Mexico, and the Sky Island mountain ranges in southeast Arizona, southwest New Mexico, and northern Mexico. When there was no action on either by mid-1998, the center filed petitions to protect both under the Endangered Species Act. Bruce Babbitt did nothing, saying that because both were already candidates, then they fell under the warranted but precluded section of law. U.S. District Judge John Roll refused to order him to act. Babbitt finally did propose listing the frog last year. That resolved the issue for the frog, but Berzon said the court is weighing in to state that Babbitt and now Norton have no choice but to follow the act and act within the time frame set by Congress on all petitions. The statute is not at all ambiguous, instead is exquisitely clear concerning what the Secretary of Interior must do when he or she receives a petition, Berzon said. She said that reflects the intent of Congress for prompt action and not what could be delay after delay by simply declaring a species a candidate for listing. The cases of both the frog, which the Secretary identified as a candidate in 1991, and the chub, which has been a candidate for nearly 2 decades without ever being the subject of formal findings, demonstrate that potentially qualified species may sit on candidate lists for extraordinarily long periods before becoming the subject of protective rules, Berzon wrote. It was precisely these situations that Congress intended the petitioning process to interrupt by requiring an immediate review. And this story came from the Arizona Daily Star and was written by Howard Fisher and brought to us by the Oregon Wild Campaign. And you can find them at www.onrc.org, and we thank them very much for that story. Well, that's just about as much time as we have right now for news on Earth First Radio. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's cruzief@cruzio.com, cruzief@cruzio, or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061, and be sure to send all announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. They really need their subscriptions right now, too. Their address is P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. That's Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Go to the website www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so tune in any time. If you want to find an Earth First Radio archive show on the World Wide Web, go to www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio, followed by the number 4, followed by all.net. And search for Earth First Radio. This is show number 149. Earth First Radio is carrying on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Be sure to ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. One of the stations that currently broadcast Earth First Radio is lover.com. That's www.luver.com. And Earth First Radio is heard on Lover Radio at 10 p.m. on Saturday nights. Earth First Radio was produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. My name is Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to some poetry by Gnome. This is from a Round River Rendezvous and concerns a Round River Rendezvous, which I'll be at in a few days.
Me and Peg were talking or maybe joking or something that this rendezvous is pretty close to where Dave Foreman lives. So maybe he's here. Maybe it was just joking, though, but I know that he is here. He's just in disguise. So this is called Dave Foreman in Disguise. I was hiking through the San Juan Mounts around the rendezvous, thinking of all who've come and gone. What's there left to do? There's 20 years of history suddenly behind us, since five bold men in cowboy hats had long ago defined us. When I caught the scent of cigar smoke wafting through the breeze and stumbled on a porta potty stashed amongst the trees, beside it stood a barbecue topped with cheeseburgers and steaks, and a flask of gin and tonic, like I've heard Nancy makes. Well, I found nature calling. Ahem. I opened the door and had to gag. There I found Dave Foreman taking a dump beneath the American flag. Foreman jumped in shock at this unsolicited relation. I said, "Excuse me, Mr. Foreman, but this deserves an explanation." Well, Dave said, "Rendezvous so close to home," and I was on the edge of tears. "I miss you all sometimes. It's been too many years. Though I wake up scared at night, Earth First still feels appealing. I had to come to cleanse my soul. I had to come for healing." I asked Dave what he thought about this movement's reaction, but Foreman said, "Hush, hush, Gnome. This visit's called a covert action. Don't tell." I pondered what that meant. Then I couldn't believe my eyes. Foreman donned a skirt and tie-dye as part of his disguise. He put patchouli in his underarms and wore a t-shirt of the dead, then put a wig of dreadlocks above his balding head. Dave said, "They'll never know," and made me promise not to tell. "We'll be hanging out at next year's rendezvous as well." Well, the light was getting dimmer, and the mosquitoes started stinging. Foreman headed off to the campfire to join along with Daryl's singing. So when there's a hippie talking next to you, don't listen to his lies. Just whisper in his ear, "Hey, you're Dave Foreman in disguise."